Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This year we celebrate the successful conclusion to one of the best-known events in American history, the Berlin Airlift. 50 years ago, as we speak, the Allied powers of the United States, Britain, and France were in the process of flying hundreds of thousands of supply missions into the city of Berlin, ground access to which the Soviets had closed. How did such a crisis ever come about? In a moment, we'll take up that and other questions concerning the Berlin Airlift with Eileen Dugan when she talks to historian Douglas Brinkley. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1942, Lieutenant Colonel James H. Doolittle gave the United States a much-needed morale boost. As a lieutenant colonel at the Army headquarters in Washington, Doolittle's job was to plan the United States' first aerial raid on Japan. Yet instead of simply planning the strike, Doolittle insisted on leading it. So on April 18, 1942, Doolittle led 16 B-25 bombers from the carrier USS Hornet on a risky 740-mile attack on the Japanese cities of Tokyo, Yokohama, Kobe, Osaka, and Nagoya. The strike could not have come at a better time. With America's confidence and morale still shaken from the events at Pearl Harbor and the Japanese seeming invincibility in the Pacific, Doolittle's daring raid gave Americans something around which they could rally. Although he had to crash land over China, he and his crew were rescued and brought back to the States, where Doolittle was promoted to Brigadier General and awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. Turning to items of interest in the news, armed with metal detectors, a team of mountaineers in Tibet are about to attack the slopes of Mount Everest to uncover clues to one of the mountain's many mysteries. Who climbed it first? The team will retrace the steps of two British climbers, George Mallory and Andrew Irvin, who were last seen just 900 feet from the summit of Everest in 1924, 29 years before the first known successful conquest of the world's tallest mountain. Of special interest to the team are the missing climbers' cameras that could provide clues to whether or not the two men made it to the top before perishing. The last living ex-commander of a Nazi concentration camp recently pleaded not guilty to charges that he was responsible for the torture, killings, and mass persecutions that took place at Jasenovac, also known as Death Factory, a wartime concentration camp in Croatia. Dinko Sekic is accused of crimes against humanity and the deaths of over 2,000 people during his 8-month command of the camp. Sekic, now 77 years old, who had lived in Argentina until sent back to Croatia, could face up to 20 years in prison if convicted. And finally, a panel of experts assembled at New York University recently ranked the top 100 works in journalism of the 20th century. First was John Hershey's Hiroshima, a vivid account of the world's first nuclear attack through the eyes of 6 survivors. Other notable works included Norman Mailer's The Armies of the Night, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, Robert Capa's photography of D-Day in Normandy, and Eddie Adams' shot of a South Vietnamese general executing a Viet Cong suspect. You are listening to Talking History. Years ago, the United States and the Soviet Union moved perilously close to turning what had been a Cold War into a hot or shooting war. Just 3 years after soldiers of the two powers embraced each other as victors over Germany, American and Soviet forces stood ready to fight one another. The episode lasted 15 months. Here to take us back 50 years to the Berlin Airlift is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan, who will be speaking to our special guest, Douglas Brinkley.
The Berlin Airlift is remembered as one of the most dramatic and important Allied efforts in Europe after World War II. Between June 1948 and September 1949, the air forces of the United States, Britain, and France combined for over 275,000 flight missions to supply a beleaguered city. With us today to discuss the Berlin Airlift is Dr. Douglas Brinkley. Dr. Brinkley is professor of history at the University of New Orleans and director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies. Welcome, Professor Brinkley.
Thank you for having me on.
What prompted the beginning of the Berlin Airlift?
Well, the end of World War II, really. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was president and died in April of 1945, and FDR always believed that they would be able to have a kind of unified Europe. Well, as we well know, that didn't happen. You had the beginnings of the Cold War, and really you had a much more conservative Truman administration that came in foreign policy that saw the Soviet Union as a threat to the United States, and in many ways Stalin as being a threat as menacing as Adolf Hitler. And you had Winston Churchill in 1946, famous Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri, describing the emergence of a East-West divide. And so there was a snowballing effect. In 1947, you had the Truman Doctrine, which gave massive U.S. aid to Greece and Turkey. And you had George Kennan's Containment Doctrine, which said we're going to stop the spread of Soviet communism. Well, lo and behold, here it is in March of 1948, and the Soviets begin tightening their grip on Berlin by closing the freight lines between first Munich and Hamburg, and thereafter allowing only limited freight traffic into Berlin. And that continuing tightening continued in throughout June, step by step, until on June 18, 1948, when the West announced a currency reform that would affect Western-occupied Germany, but not Berlin. There became a kind of showdown over there. From the American point of view, it was holding firm in Berlin, showing that we will not allow the western sector of the city to fall into the Soviet hands. From the Soviet Union point of view, they were worried about losing so many millions of workers from East Berliners and others who were pouring, using Berlin, West Berlin as an open city and pouring into the West.
Now, what are some of the basic statistics of the Berlin airlift, like how many personnel were involved, flights and such?
Well, it's mind-boggling, really. I mean, if you begin that, it was on June 24, 1948, that the Soviets imposed a blockade, and they began suspending all telephone and postal transport services to Berlin. From June 24th, the Berlin blockade was of 48 was not lifted to May 12, 1949. So essentially, it went on for 10 months. In 18 days. And during that nerve-wracking time, the West delivered an astounding 2,325,000 tons of supplies. That's, 2,325,000 tons of supplies, about two-thirds of it coal. And the U.S. and the British had about 277,000 flights that occurred during that 10-month 18-day period.
Now, you mentioned coal is being flown in. What else was brought in?
Food. Was brought in. Wood. Any kind of provisions. I mean, Berlin was a starving, hungry city. And one of the things that's amazing about Berlin, picture living there in 1945, the sound of an American airplane flying over Berlin in 44 and 45 brought terror in the heart of Berliners. It meant that the city was going to be bombed, that it was an air raid. Now it's 1948, and the sound of an American plane meant candy bars, bread, vegetables, milk, coal, wood, clothes. And so it's a very dramatic difference that took place in a few years there.
Now, looking at the stats about 277 flights, as you say, over essentially 10 months. That is an astounding number of flights per day. They must have been coming in on a very regular basis. I mean, was there any kind of air traffic control to keep problems from happening?
Well, it was a primitive air traffic control by today's standards. But these guys, I've interviewed a number of the Berlin Air pilots. I recently had through a conference at the National Archives, and just had all the veterans of the airlift come, as many as I could locate, and they would tell stories. I mean, some days, some of these pilots would do five dump-offs a day, if you like, five drops a day. They'd be flying back and forth in shuttle fashion, and there were dangers that occurred that the air traffic controllers had to worry about, mainly snow and cold weather. The reason why the Soviet Union and East Germany never believed this airlift would work, that we couldn't deliver it through the weather, that the pilots couldn't make it through the Berlin winter dropping these supplies off. And we do want to remember that there were 78 airmen that lost their lives in crashes and accidents during the airlift.
Now, you mentioned snow being a factor, but of course the snow isn't all year round, and Berlin was surrounded by Soviet-held territory. How were the planes able to get to Berlin? Were there corridors or something?
There were flight corridors. And remember, when they sealed off the rail, shut off all the rail traffic, and as I said, postal traffic, trains aren't allowed to come in, kind of isolated Western Berlin. They could not cut off the air traffic. I mean, it's impossible to have barriers in the sky. But the question that leads to is, why didn't the Soviet Union not shoot down these planes? Why did the Soviet Union show restraint? Well, the first thing is they thought it would never work, that the Berliners would get hungry and tired, that the Americans would lose their resolve. Of course, that didn't happen. But remember, the United States was the only nuclear power in the world in 1948. We were, in those few years from 45 to 1949, where we were the sole country in the world that had nuclear weapons. So the Soviet Union was very fearful of America's nuclear arsenal. And they did not shoot down U.S. and British aircraft. And they also feared that if they did, that would mean war, and they may lose all of Berlin. And even then, all of Eastern Europe as a security zone. And it would have been a war between the United States and Russia.
What are some of the more memorable episodes, and who are some of the more memorable people in the story of the Berlin Airlift?
Well, the most memorable is Harry Truman, I think, in history, because this is Truman's moment of great resolve. Historians debate what Truman's, how he came to the decision to stand so firm in Berlin. But it is clear that at some point in a famous meeting, Truman said the last word after discussing it was, "We are going to stay, period." And that's a famous quote of Harry Truman. At that point, the other American characters that fall into the drama are General Lucius Clay, who called General Curtis E. LeMay, who was U.S. Air Force Chief in Europe, and he said, basically, this is in June of 48, Kurt, General LeMay, can you transport coal by air? And once LeMay said, yes, we can transport it by air, that's when the Berlin Airlift was born. And within days of Truman saying we're going to stay, period, and LeMay saying, yes, we can transport coal by air, you began the around-the-clock flights into Berlin, dropping a total of 13,000 tons of goods a day. And just imagine 13,000 tons going in a day and keeping up day after day for 60 days. And what they're doing is feeding and supplying the city of Berlin. And at that point, Berlin had 2.5 million people. And they had to give them everything, as I mentioned before, that would keep a modern city alive, from machinery and clothing, food, medicine, and other vital items. And what occurred in Berlin, the other people, those are some of the American people, LeMay and Clay and Truman. In Berlin, I think some of the great heroes in Berlin itself were the spotters. And you see great photographs of these. These are young Berliners who would look up into the sky and wave down these four-engine C-54s in hopes they would drop candy bars and oranges. And what really became so impressive is that about 23 tons of goods were dropped from the sky for children. And there was one young Berlin victim of the Soviet blockade who said the sounds of engines was like music to our ears, because every day the young people of Berlin would come out and listen to that. And recently I got to meet one of those young spotters, who's now a well-to-do German businessman who's living in Berlin and has made a very moving speech about how much he has to thank the United States Air Force for risking their lives to feed his family during those very crucial and cold months of the winter of 48-49.
Now, another one of the people that we sometimes think of with the Berlin Airlift are some of the men who flew in it, like one hears of the Candyman.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. The Candyman's become quite famous because it just is what I said. It became public relations in this sense. Here's somebody who now would parachute down bags of candy for kids, and it became quite famous. The point being here, it was the people of Berlin were loving the United States. They were loving the United States Air Force. This is Berlin that we were our mortal enemies just a few years ago, and now the sight of Americans was something quite incredible. I've interviewed pilots before that have taken the most missions. A lot of them are proud of how many flights they flew. And all of these people, the veterans of the Berlin Airlift, are great American heroes. And, you know, I don't think we can honor them enough. And I think in this 50th anniversary year, we should be doing just like your program is, bringing attention to this dramatic flashpoint, this incredibly crucial moment in global history that occurred 50 years ago. We sometimes talk about D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge and war events in Europe, but following World War II, the key pivotal moment in the Cold War was the Berlin Airlift, when we were able to, it was the Soviet Union who blinked, and Berlin became the bone in the throat of Soviet Russia, and it became the symbol of democracy in the Cold War. When the Berlin Wall went up in 1961, it was very clear. On the western side of the wall was free enterprise, was open marketplace, was music, joy, happiness, and neon. And on the Soviet side, in East Germany, East Berlin, it was all drab, concrete, totalitarian ugliness. And so Berlin became a symbol of the virtues of the West, Western philosophy over the Eastern philosophy.
Yes, in that context, I always remember the KaDeWe, the massive department store in Berlin. That was a real show place for West Berlin.
Oh, it really was. It was mind-boggling. I was spent some time in West Berlin while the wall was still up, it was just always amazing. I would go through Checkpoint Charlie and actually go to graves of some famous Germans that were buried in East Berlin. As a historian, I was interested in going to Bertolt Brecht and Heidegger's graves, for example, which were in East Berlin. And I used to drive around East Berlin quite a bit, and was just always astounded to see that buildings, this is in the 80s, that buildings were still like bombed out from the Second World War and hadn't been even cleaned up. It was such a stark contrast. And in a way, Berlin became the symbol of the Cold War in the world.
Now, how do the Germans remember the Airlift itself, and how are they commemorating it?
Well, they commemorated it by having President Clinton there this past spring. He came a little bit before the 50th anniversary, but they made a great deal of hoopla there about remembering 50 years later. And remember, it was the Berliners who were heroes, too. These were people in Berlin that said, we don't want anything to do with the Soviet Union. We want democracy. We want freedom. So it's one of those events, unlike World War II history, where the Germans really do want to forget, the Nazi regime, the Third Reich. By contrast, today's modern Germany has paid a great deal of attention in the media and press and honoring various American pilots, British pilots, and also German air traffic controllers and German, remember, the German workers who would unload these planes, and then they'd have to go and get the food out to everybody. And so they feel very proud in Berlin that they had the guts and tenacity, temerity to be part of this blockade effort and to not flinch when the going it got tough because they believed in freedom.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Brinkley. We've been talking to Dr. Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at the University of New Orleans and director at the Eisenhower Center for American Studies.
Continuing on our subject of the Berlin Airlift, we have asked Roger G. Miller, historian for the Department of the Air Force, to share with us his thoughts on what happened in 1948 and 1949. Dr. Miller is the author of To Save a City, The Berlin Airlift. He has titled his op-ed for today, The Berlin Airlift, Some Reflections on a Cold War Victory.
The Berlin Airlift was the greatest humanitarian airlift in history, the first great Western victory of the Cold War, and the first victory by an independent U.S. Air Force. Myths about the Berlin crisis of 1948-1949 and their airlift persist. Historians continue to assert that Joseph Stalin's goal was to force the Western Allies out of Berlin, but the blockade he imposed had a different purpose. The cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy after World War II was a politically stable Europe, which required a strong European economy. and by the end of 1947, it was clear that this required the economic recovery of Germany. The Soviet Union, however, opposed any measure that threatened to strengthen Germany. Finally, British, American, and French ministers met in London in February 1948, agreed to merge their occupation zones, and planned to establish a democratic German government. These measures infuriated Stalin. Ultimately, the Berlin blockade was an effort not to force the Western Allies out of Berlin, but to pressure their leaders to reverse the decisions taken at the London Conference. Nikita Khrushchev once described the process in his rather earthy way by comparing Berlin with certain male anatomical features. "If I want the West to scream," he told his cronies, "I merely squeeze Berlin." The Berlin airlift was never a solution to the Berlin blockade. Rather, it was a temporary measure that enabled Western leaders to buy the time needed to seek a diplomatic solution. Further, no one planned the airlift or foresaw that it could become that expedient. It was a logical response to the blockade implemented by British and American military leaders in Germany. When the airlift began in late June 1948, no one believed that it would be needed for more than a few weeks. By September, however, positions had hardened. Soviet leaders fell back on Russia's great ally, Winter, to ground the C-54s. For Western leaders, the airlift had to continue. Lacking other options, they ended up gambling, betting all on the roll of the dice in an operation that few, quite frankly, really believed could succeed. They wagered Berlin, Western Germany, and the American position in post-war Europe on the steady thunder of Pratt & Whitney engines. Many still believe that the Soviet Union and the Western powers were on the verge of World War III. In truth, neither side was prepared for or wanted war. Both sides were willing to push the other where they thought advantage could be gained, but throughout the Berlin crisis, they carefully avoided any action that might threaten war. The blockade was designed to gain Soviet ends without war. The airlift was an unwarlike countermeasure. Appropriately, the most suitable epitaph for the airlift flew into Berlin by airplane. Inscribed on the nose of a Royal Air Force C-47 were the words, Psalm 21, verse 11. Reference the Soviet blockade of Berlin, the biblical citation proclaimed victory. For they intended evil against thee. They imagined a mischievous device, which they are not able to perform.
You've been listening to Roger Miller, historian for the Department of the Air Force and the author of To Save a City, The Berlin Airlift, 1948 to 1949. And this is Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History and our show on the Berlin Airlift. For our site of the week, we've chosen one of the most extensive sources of information on the Berlin Airlift, and it is literally at your fingertips. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The U.S. Air Forces in Europe Berlin Airlift website is chock full of information about the Berlin Airlift. There is a guide of quick facts about the airlift, a list of key players, video clips of the aircraft used in the Herculean effort, and charts and graphs and video of the air corridors used in the operation. There is a section on the obstacles faced by the U.S. Air Force, the Soviet blockade, and that also includes video clips. You can even check out the difference between payload comparisons of the Berlin airlift and today. Anything and everything you want to know about the Berlin airlift is included in this site, and it is well worth the virtual tour. You can reach the site by searching for the U.S. Air Forces in Europe Berlin airlift site.
Thank you, Cindy. And for those interested in a more real-time experience on the Berlin airlift, I'd recommend the U.S. Air Force Museum at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, you may be interested in a forthcoming public broadcasting American Experience television production on General Douglas MacArthur, a soldier both much admired and reviled, the liberator of the Philippines and shogun of occupied Japan, who led U.S. troops in Korea only to be relieved of his command by President Harry Truman. MacArthur, as it is titled, will be aired on Monday and Tuesday, May 17th and 18th. Also scheduled for PBS in the American Experience series is Fly Girls, wherein you'll meet the woman who joined the Women Air Force Service pilots, known as the WASPs, and test-piloted aircraft during World War II. Fly Girls will air on Monday, May 24th. Be sure to check your local listings for exact dates and times for both of these broadcasts. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when our subject will be the Gospel of Germs. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
You and I forget to do those little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a queen and foolish. So it may seem to me that everything's a mere idea of you. The longing here's for you. You never know how slow the moments go till I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower. Your eyes in stars above. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
The very thought of you, my love.